just remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Good morning, Vietnam, and good timely greeting to you, dear listener. Welcome back to another exciting installment here at Play It Again, Kyla. I have been waiting to do this film basically since I started this podcast. The movie of the hour today is none other than Steel Magnolias, which is a seminal classic if you are a young girl growing up in the American South. And I'm super excited about the guest that I have on the show for today. It's my good friend, Erin, my high school friend, Erin. She's my friend outside of high school, too. That's just a nice little inside joke between us and our friend group. But Erin is someone who has seen this movie probably even more times than me, which is shocking because, as I said, as a girl growing up in the American South, this movie is just part of your formative childhood experience. Like, you grow up with Steel Magnolias if you are a woman in the American South. And so I'm really excited for the conversation that's going to be had today. I'm really excited to get to discuss this film with Erin in particular. If you haven't seen this film before, I definitely recommend it. I can't recommend it strongly or highly enough, but I hope that you'll watch it before listening because we're really gonna get into what makes this the funniest movie that will ever make you cry, as the tagline of the film suggested and said. So it is, in fact, the funniest movie that will ever make you cry. And so let's go ahead and just dive on in, shall we?
Here we go! I don't want to have to kill you.
Don't you threaten me, Drum Eatington.
Drum would never, ever point a gun at a lady.
Your husband is a boil on the butt of humanity.
TriStar Pictures presents...
Well, this is it. You're finally rid of me.
Sally Field.
Oh, I think you'd be back every now and then.
Dolly Parton.
How's your family?
Louis brought his girlfriend home, and the nicest thing I can say about her is all of her tattoos are spelled correctly.
I miss you.
Ugh, leave me alone.
Shirley MacLaine.
I'm not crazy, Malin. I've just been in a very bad mood for 40 years.
Daryl Hannah.
Miss Trudy, I swear to you that my personal tragedy will not interfere with my ability to do good hair.
Olympia Dukakis.
Looks like two pigs fighting under a blanket.
Julia Roberts.
I'm going to make you very happy.
I want a child of my own.
Your poor body has been through so much. Why would you deliberately do this to yourself?
Diabetics have healthy babies all the
you
time.
You are special, Shelby.
Time has made them close. Life.
She's gonna have a baby. Go get a doctor.
Has made them friends. Steel Magnolias, the funniest movie that will ever make you cry.
So here today to help me discuss the film of the hour, Steel Magnolias, is a very special guest, Erin. Introduce yourself, Erin.
Hi everyone. My name is Erin. I'm an Enneagram 9. Just so you know a little bit about me. And all of my social media is Erin _ 2 and then ME. Yeah.
You're going to tell them you're my high school friend?
Yeah, I'm Kyla's high school friend. it's the only way I know her. We have never spoken.
Outside of the walls of Cook High School, we have never spoken.
She's never met my family.
Never spent Christmas with them.
She does not know who I am.
They do not know that I don't eat meat in her family.
They actually don't. They forget that all the time.
Sonya knows. She always offers to make me a grilled cheese.
Old Bev is
she's always
what
like,
do you
what's
mean
wrong?
You don't eat no meat.
And Catherine's like, that's okay. I make lamb. All right. So now that we've broken that down, gone off script and quoted my big fat Greek wedding, not even a minute in, let's go ahead and allow Erin to answer my standard getting to know you questionnaire. Since though Erin is very old and familiar to me, to you, my dear listeners, she's a newbie here. So
awesome.
You ready?
Yeah.
All right. So the first question that I ask all my guests, Erin, is what do you consider to be the greatest film ever made?
I'm stealing from you, Kyla. I do agree with you that it is Gone with the
Wind. This is one thing on which you agree with me.
Yeah. I grew up watching that movie. I think at this point in like history or whatever, that maybe is very important to look back on it and say, okay, we can respect this film for what it is and respect the acting, respect like the direction, all of that, but also be critical of it and realize that like the underlying rhetoric of it is something that's like not acceptable, and but it's still like a time, like not a timeless movie, but one of those movies that every generation like can get something out of and learn from.
I agree. I think that what makes Gone with the Wind so special is, first and foremost, to me, nothing will top Gone with the Wind as a technical masterpiece. Like it is Selznick's triumph. It the fact that he was able to do that in 1939 is insane. The fact that there are shots within which every working member of the Screen Actors Guild are on screen, like that's just insane. The fact that he was utilizing every Technicolor camera in existence, like nothing can trump that. But then adding on to that, like you were saying, the discussions that that film can bring about, because we need to discuss those things and we need to be aware. And I love learning the behind the scenes of that movie, because it's interesting in a heartbreaking way to like learn, like the history of Hattie McDaniel.
Like I don't know if you've seen that Netflix series.
And like it's just so, there's so many lessons to be learned, and there's so much. It's, to me, it's a great example of like, it's a microcosm of humanity. It's a technical triumph, but there was still so much tragedy wrapped up in it.
And just like, it's a time capsule of golden Hollywood. I mean, wow. Like Vivian Leigh and Olivia
de Havilland.
Like, oh my gosh. But yeah, no, I was going to tell, I know I've told you this story, but I love to tell it. Growing up, I thought that every actress was Olivia de Havilland in, like, a different costume. Like, Olivia de Havilland was the actress to me. And I also thought, because I didn't understand how recordings worked, this is when I was very young, I thought that just the picture was recorded. And then the actors and actresses, every time someone put
like VHS came out in, and did that,
like, went into a studio to like send the voice to you. And so I thought Vivian Leigh was like still alive, being like, there Aaron goes again.
Vivian Leigh's like, dang, this girl needs to put this DVD up. I love that though, because that's like, there's something so intimate about movie watching when you're a kid. Like, you really feel like it's happening for you. So, like, there's something magical about that, that little Aaron thought that Vivian Leigh was, like, talking directly to her. Yeah.
Specifically, though, I thought that Vivian Leigh and Judy Garland, like, I thought that they were the, like, no costume added. Like, I just thought they were the same.
That's so funny.
And so, every time I'd watch The Wizard of Oz, I thought that, like, oh, if I plug in Gone with the Wind right now, as soon as I
she'll have to stop.
She'll have to like run to a different studio. Oh my God.
That's hilarious. I love that. I want to do like an episode on like craziest realizations you had about movies as a child, because like that. But that's probably one reason that this movie in particular is so special to you. And, you know, that's why Natalie Portman is so special to me, because that's when I realized, like, that's what an actress does. And so I just, there's something so intimate about that, you know, about that experience for a young child. But that's so funny. Aaron and I have gotten into quite a few heated debates over who was the superior golden age of Hollywood actress, Vivian Leigh or Olivia de Havilland.
I personally believe it was Vivian Leigh, but again, I think that's just because I have so much, like, sentiment attached to her. She's also an amazing actress.
Like, she is. So is Olivia de Havilland.
Okay, yes, but, like, okay, let's bring in a TikTok reference. Vivian Leigh is the main character, and Olivia de Havilland is the side character.
That's not true at all. They have the same number of Best Actress Oscars.
Agree to disagree here.
All right, it's fine.
I mean, in life, like, Vivian's the main character. Olivia is the side character.
Olivia lasted until just a few months ago.
I know, I was so devastated.
Yeah, same. Aaron and I text each other, we're like, are you okay?
That was my
like, Kyla's gonna slip into a coma.
It was so okay. Hang on, backstory. We have to explain that Aaron and I, we in high school, we forced my mother to drive us from deep South Georgia to just outside Atlanta to a Gone with the Wind museum. Mm-hmm. And a lot of interesting things went down that day. But we, in the Gone with the Wind museum, we were the only people there. There was no one else there. It was us and these two elderly women that ran the museum. And one of them, I wanted a mug that had Olivia de Havilland's face on it. And I went to check out and the lady was like, oh, yeah, Olivia is the only member of the cast of this film who's still alive. And I was like, hey, tell me something I don't know. but then she was like, yeah, she used to, like, you like, I think they exchanged letters. Isn't that what it was? That they, like, were pen pals. And she was like, yeah, but the dementia's really set in and she can't write me anymore. And I
thought Kyla was going to lose it.
I was like, excuse me, Olivia de Havilland is unwell. And so, like, the whole way home, Aaron was like, this is the worst day of Kyla's life. Like,
and poor Niecy, she was just like, I know, boo.
I know. My mom's like, it's okay. And so, no, the love for Olivia de Havilland runs really deep, but the love for Vivien Leigh does as well. And I will say, Aaron, I agree with you that in terms of the golden age of Hollywood, Vivien Leigh had the more direct impact, I think, when we think of figureheads of that era, we think of Vivien Leigh, but when we think of staying power, we think of Olivia de Havilland. So
I mean, I can agree with you there. They're both iconic women that did amazing things. Mm-hmm.
We respect them both. Yeah. In this house, we respect both.
If you don't, get out.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so all of that was under my first question. So my second question, Aaron, is what's the film that you've seen the most times and why?
It would probably be a tie between Steel Magnolias and the film version of Phantom of the Opera.
Mm-hmm.
And the Phantom of the Opera one, don't get me wrong, I love that movie. I've learned within the past year that there's a lot of controversy about that movie. But I like that movie, and if you don't, sorry about you, but Caroline, my younger sister, when we were, like, when she was, like, 2 or 3 years old, everywhere we went, we had to watch that. Like, it had to be in the car. If we went and stayed the night at someone's house, she had to bring it with her, and she called it Phantom of the Office.
And that's so cute!
And, so because she watched it so much, I have seen it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But Steel Magnolias, I've watched it so many times because my mom loves it, my grandma loves it, my older sister Catherine loves it, I love it. It's a feel-good movie. I'll come home sometimes and just, like, put it on to, have while I'm doing other things because I know it so well that, I know what's going on. I can quote it with them, you know? So.
Yeah, no, it's a good one, and it's one, you know, it's a requirement if you grew up where we grew up that's one of the movies you've seen the most.
For sure.
Yeah. So my next question for you, Aaron, is do you prefer to see movies in theaters or do you like watching them at home more?
I like watching them at home, and I'll tell you why, Kyla.
Tell me why, Aaron.
It has to do with you.
I'm intrigued.
Let's think back to the time we went to see Star Wars in theaters. What happened during that, Kyla?
I said aloud, I love Kylo Ren.
How many times, Kyla?
Quite a few.
Okay, I cannot stand when people talk through a movie and I'm unable to pause it. And so then I miss things. And that happens. There's always a baby or a cell phone or Kyla.
Listen, okay, I had a very emotional reaction to seeing Adam Driver in The Force Awakens, okay? I really love Kylo Ren.
So, I like being in my pajamas, perhaps with a coffee and a pillow, watching the movie, and if someone were to interrupt, I would simply press pause and get back to it at a different time.
I feel like, Aaron, with you and I specifically, we have paused movies and, like,
never gone back to it.
It happens.
last night we didn't even start the movie.
Yeah, it's true. We didn't even, the TV was on and we were going to watch the movie and then we talked for like 6 hours and we were like, whoops, we'll watch it in the morning. It's fine. But I also prefer at home because I like to be able to talk while the movie is on, and I don't do that in the theater all that often. Now, The Force Awakens was a very special case because, first of all, we were on the front row.
You're always on the front row.
I know. I like to see movies from the front row.
When we went to Jackie, you were like, there were so many seats, and you were like, no, you see those two crowded seats at the front? That's where we're going.
And we enjoyed that experience, did we not?
We did.
How many times have I made us drive to Tallahassee to see a movie?
At least three. At least.
Why do people put up with me?
Because Kylo's entertaining at a certain point.
You just gotta cut your losses and be like, this is just what we're dealing with at this point.
I guess.
All right. So, next question for you, Erin. What's your earliest movie watching memory?
Annie.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah, my grandma would, my grandma on my mom's side, old Bev, she would put on Annie for nap time.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, but the reason why, you've met my grandma.
Yes.
She's very much a Mrs. Hannigan minus the alcoholism.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, she would like put it on and we'd be like, we love you, Granny, and she'd be like, oh, shut up, go to like in a joking way, but uh-huh. That's like what would happen. Uh-huh. So that's one of my
earliest movie memories. Yeah. That's cute though.
Yeah.
No one else has brought up Annie yet so far on this podcast, which I'm kind of surprised about. So
really?
Mm-hmm.
Daddy Warbucks, like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. And my final getting to know you question, Erin, what is a movie that you think everyone should see at least once in their lifetime?
Funny you should ask, Kyla. It's still Magnolia.
I should have known. Uh-huh.
I mean, I think that movie, it does a really good job of depicting Southern life in, like, a positive light, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. But it also does that with female friendships and relationships, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it offers a great juxtaposition between like the dainty Southern woman and like the hard as nails Southern woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like that you can be both. You can be Sally Fields.
You can be Sally Field. You too can be Sally Field.
Like, it can happen.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like it's empowering to mm-hmm. women. I think if you identify as a male and you're watching that movie, you can like gather some respect, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just can offer anything to anyone, you know, different lessons to everybody.
Mm-hmm. And see, I didn't even know that was gonna be your answer. And like, that's the film I brought you here to discuss, but yeah. I didn't know that was gonna be your answer for two separate getting to know you questions.
I just love this movie. Okay, uh-huh.
It's a good one. It's a good one. So before we dive into our specific discussion about Steel Magnolias, I want to offer some behind the scenes fun facts, as I always do here on the show. And so I just got a few because I know Erin and I have a lot to discuss with this movie, but they're all pretty interesting to me. The first of which is not so fun if you're Julia Roberts. It's that Sally Field and Shirley MacLaine have both spoken about how difficult director Herbert Ross was to work with, and that he was specifically very hard on Julia Roberts. And there were multiple takes that ended with her just like in tears because he was berating her so horribly.
I think I'd heard that before. Not to that extent, but I'd heard that he was kind of... Am I allowed to cuss on the podcast?
Sure, go ahead.
I just heard that he was like a real hard ass just like throughout the entire film production.
And that it's kind of ironic, which we're going to talk about this later on to me, though, that you have a film that is at its core about these intimate relationships between women written by a man and directed by a man.
Yeah.
Like, that's just interesting to me. Because of the intricacies of female interpersonal relationships that are portrayed here, like, you would think that it would have a more female touch, but yeah, poor Julia Roberts. I know I'm biased, I love Julia Roberts, I think her performance here is really good.
Oh, it is.
So I can't imagine someone,
like, what, did, What did he say is what I would like to know,
to reduce Julia Roberts to tears. But also, you got to bear in mind, this is Julia Roberts at this point in her life. She's not yet the Julia Roberts that we think of. Like, she's not Pretty Woman yet.
That's true.
You know, I feel like after Pretty Woman, Herbert Ross couldn't have made her cry.
That's true.
So, the next fact also deals with director Herbert Ross and his behavior on set. After a particularly poor take, he was reprimanding Dolly Parton and asked, "Can you even act?" To which Dolly Parton responded, "No, but it's your job to make it look like I can."
I love this woman so much.
We in this house, we stan.
We sure do.
We stan Dolly Parton.
We sure do.
I feel like as a Southern woman, Dolly Parton is one of, like, you must.
Oh, yeah.
You must respect Dolly Parton.
My favorite fun facts about Dolly Parton is that she owns the
amusement park. Yeah, near our houses. Yeah. For those of you who didn't grow up in Tipton/Adel, there is this tiny little amusement park known as Wild Adventures that Dolly Parton charitably bought out when it was at risk of going under. And it's now, like, her secondary Dollywood, question mark?
Yeah, this amusement park was famously in Zombieland.
It's yes.
The amusement park at the end of the movie.
Yep. Good times.
Good times indeed.
You yeah. I will say, though, a grilled cheese costs $12 at Wild Adventures. Really? And I'm like, Dolly.
$12. Mm-hmm. I love Wild Adventures during, like, Halloween time.
Me too. Wild Adventures is, like, I really like Wild Adventures.
I do too. Like, I think it's kind of underrated.
It is. It's a really cool thing to have in that area of Georgia.
Especially during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what else are you going to do in 8L?
Nothing. So, quite literally nothing.
Might as well go to Wild Adventures.
An Ice Pharaoh's Fury. Let's go. An icebreaker in one of my classes at GW was, we had to respond to the question of the person sitting across from us, and they got to ask us a question based on, like, our name and hometown. And so I was like, my name's Kyla. I'm from Tipton/Adel, Georgia. Because, like, it's hard for me to... I'm from Tipton, but I went to high school in Adel. And so the girl was like, what do people do for fun in that area of Georgia?
There are three things.
And I was like, we drive to Valdosta.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally all I could think to say.
We hang out in the Walmart parking lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Or
the Depot parking lot. Mm-hmm. So, but because of Dolly Parton... You respect Dolly Parton. Everyone respects Dolly Parton if you're from our area of the South, regardless. But growing up in the shadow of an amusement park that she owned, like, it was that much more heightened. Yeah, you're like, thank you for giving us something to do, Dolly. Without you, we quite literally would just be sitting in the Depot parking lot. But yeah, so I love that fun fact of her just being like, nope, but it's your job to make it look like I can.
A sass queen. We stan.
I'm gonna push back on Dolly, but I think Dolly can act.
Oh, I do too.
I really do, because she shows the wealth of emotion.
Let that director come near me. I will throw hands. Do not disrespect Dolly.
All right, next one is that Meg Ryan was originally under contract to play Shelby in this movie, but she was released because she preferred to play Sally in When Harry Met Sally, and so the studio released her.
Can we talk about, like, what a serendipitous thing that is? We would not have... The two great movies would not be what they are.
Exactly. Like, Meg Ryan has to be Sally, and I really think Julia Roberts has to be Shelby. I question whether Julia Roberts would have the career trajectory that she has had without this film.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Because I feel like...
This catapulted her.
Yeah, that enabled her to get, like, Pretty Woman.
Exactly. And so, thank you, Meg Ryan, for choosing Sally over Shelby, honestly. And that's...
God had a hand in history there. Yes.
And that's... We're going to talk as we go on about, like, how just, like, intrinsically linked these actresses are with the roles that they're playing here, which is so interesting to us because, like, this is first and foremost a play. But the actresses who play these roles in this film version, like, I associate so definitively with these roles. Especially Julia Roberts. Like, I can't imagine anyone else as Shelby.
Same.
Which, interestingly, the next fun fact is that Winona Ryder was considered for the role of Shelby. Mm-hmm. But she was deemed too young. Like, the studio really courted her for it, and then they were like, actually, we don't know that you're old enough to portray, like, Shelby later in the film. And so...
I simply don't see it.
Me either. I can't. Also, Winona Ryder doing a Southern accent, I
no,
just
ma'am.
No, thank you. I love you, Winona Ryder.
I do too.
I do. I don't.
You're out there.
Yes.
We stand you
in this house also, but we do not believe that you could have, not that you couldn't have, but like, I just can't.
Not in the same way.
In my brain, Winona Ryder and Southern accent just don't compute.
No.
They don't go together. Even though she lives in Georgia when shooting Stranger Things.
Really?
Yeah, because they shoot in Georgia.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Daryl Hannah was actually originally turned down for the role of Annelle because the casting directors thought she was too beautiful. They're like, you're not going to be able to realistically be like the awkward, gawking person that you're supposed to be at the beginning of the film. And she was like, okay, let me come back in tomorrow. And so she came in like fully dressed like as Annelle, like trying to be as awkward and gawking as she could be. And the people at the front desk of where they were having this like casting call didn't recognize her and wouldn't let her in. They didn't believe she was Daryl Hannah.
No way.
Uh-huh. And that's how she got the role.
I love that fact.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool.
Wow.
Like, what a power move.
High School Me relates to Annelle. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this story. This is a name you'll have to bleep out, but called me frumpy in high school. And ever since then, I've just been like, you know what? I am Annelle. I will have my transition.
You're going to go to, like, beauty icon, worldly woman, and then you're gonna go to praying all the time, church woman.
You know what? I'm already Catholic. I'm halfway there.
You're already there, Erin. You are both simultaneously.
Yeah, whatever.
That's so funny though. Also, first name that I have to bleep. Thank you for that. So my next fun fact is that Daryl Hannah and Dolly Parton actually studied under real hairstylists so that they could realistically portray like what it was like to do these women's hair, especially because Dolly Parton wanted to actually do Julia Roberts' hair during the scene right before the wedding. And so I watched that especially closely on this rewatch and like, yeah, like she's fully does her
That's
hair.
That's interesting because I always thought, you know, when she's like curling the back pieces in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like she's not doing anything. It looks like she's just moving the curling iron.
Yeah,
so
but she's actually doing her hair.
That she's actually doing it this whole time. I thought it was fake.
That's, you know, though, like, what's really funny about that is usually in movies when people go to great lengths to do things realistically is those are the moments that everyone, all the keyboard warriors, like, that looks so fake. Because I'm thinking specifically, not to make this about Garden State, but the moment in Garden State where Sam's mom is like, well, you've forgotten now, Jelly's dead. And she's like waving the dead hamster around.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is always like, oh, that hamster's so fake looking. Like, that doesn't look real at all. It's a real hamster. It's a real taxidermy dead hamster.
Okay, that just solidifies my opinion on Garden State. That movie is creepy.
Stop. We're not getting into this right now.
I'm just saying.
Let me at least get through the fun facts, okay? Before you launch into your huge monologue here, because I know where this is going. Okay, so next fact is that the cemetery scene was actually shot entirely in one take.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that crazy?
Oh, my gosh. My heart.
It's so good. I'm kind of glad to know it was done in one take because, like, knowing that Sally Field just did that and knowing that it was, like, that organic and natural, that, like, it wasn't, like, take 30. Not that take 30 couldn't have been great, but, like, there's just something so special, so natural about it. And you're like, this is their first time doing this on film. Like, duh, it's natural, you know? This is an interesting one. When Bette Davis saw the off-Broadway version of this play, she immediately was like, oh, this is going to be a great film. I want to be in it. And she, like, conceived of this whole version where she would be Weezer, Katharine Hepburn would be Clary, and Elizabeth Taylor would be Truvy. But when she found out that the rights had already been sold for a movie adaptation, she found out that the production company was planning to cast much younger actresses. But, like, could you imagine that version?
That would have been wild. I would love that.
I mean,
it would be much different than what it is, but...
Also, what would you do about the Elizabeth Taylor line?
That would have been even funnier.
If Elizabeth Taylor is saying it,
you know?
Even more tragic than Elizabeth Taylor.
That would have... Wow.
Mm-hmm. iconic.
I'm picturing it in my mind.
I though like Katherine Hepburn as Clary.
Her voice.
Uh huh. Like it's, but the version we have is perfect.
Oh yeah.
And this is another interesting one about casting. Sally Field was nearly not cast as Malin because producers thought that it would not be believable to audiences that she would have a 22-year-old. Like, they thought Sally Field seemed too young to have a 22-year-old. And she's like, oh, interesting, my son is 20. And they were like, okay, you're hired. So it's interesting to me that, like, getting to the point of having the cast that we have in this film was such an odyssey. Like, there were so many near misses and everything. But I'm so glad that we have the exact cast that we do. So now, as always, Erin, to kick off the discussion of the film of the hour, I want us each to talk about our experience with this film. So I'll let you go first. Can you remember the first time you saw this film? How many times do you think you've seen it? Just what's been your general relationship with this film over the years?
Okay, so I have no clue when the first time I saw this movie was. But I do remember watching it very, very young. And the scene when Jackson comes home and finds Jack Jr. like squalling. Mm-hmm. And Shelby's just like laid out on like the back patio or whatever. That is ingrained in my mind of me watching it like in my upstairs den. And I didn't understand like mm-hmm. what was happening at the time because I was so young. I genuinely think I was like 2 or 3
mm-hmm.
and remember this. But I just remember it standing out to me. And the scene that right after that, when Malin's walking down the hallway like hurriedly and she's like clomping,
mm-hmm.
That stands out in my brain too as like one of my earliest memories is watching this movie, specifically those two parts.
Mm-hmm.
But what was another question?
Do you know how many times you've seen it?
How many times? Has to be hundreds. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no way to accurately quantify that because mm-hmm. I just watch it all the time.
Uh-huh.
Like, and, you know, like, my Trent, my boyfriend, whenever he came to meet my parents for the first time, well, not to meet them for the first time, but came down to Adel for the first time, we were trying to explain Adel to him.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was like, you know what? Just hold on. And went upstairs and got the DVD version that we have of Still mm-hmm. Magnolias and popped it in and was like, or no, she got the VHS one because she was like, it has to be the original copy I have. Uh-huh. And popped it in. And we were, the whole family, like dad and everything, we were just quoting the movie
mm-hmm.
the whole time. And he was like, what is that?
what is this called?
But then afterwards, he was like, you know what? This is a perfect portrayal of Ada.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every story that you guys have ever told me, like, the way you can just name drop people and everyone knows exactly what instance you're talking about, as well as all the background information you mm-hmm. need to know.
Yeah, so. No, I agree. It so perfectly represents small-town culture, specifically our small town.
Mm-hmm.
I also don't, first of all, you brought up the VHS and it made me remember that when Erin and I went to watch it this morning, I actually had to take the DVD out of the plastic covering because I always watch the VHS mm-hmm. of this movie. Because like when I'm home at my childhood home, like that's what we have is the VHS.
The tape hasn't like, you know how after you watch something, yeah. rewind it so many times, it like splits.
And yeah.
Stuff. I'm surprised it hasn't done that.
Me too. But I also don't remember my first exposure to this movie. I can remember like the earliest time I remember the scenes, mm-hmm. but I don't think that was the first time I'd ever seen it because right. like this was, it's like, it's just part of growing up in the South, exactly. especially as a woman is you watch this movie, it's usually with your mom
mm-hmm.
from a very young age. And so, and I think, I mentioned this to you earlier, Erin, I think there are two movies with that expectation when you grow up in the South, and that's Still Magnolias and Fried Green Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the two movies growing up that if I encountered someone who had never seen either of those movies, it just didn't compute. I was like, how?
Yeah.
How? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Like, and those
I remember at our high school put on Steel Magnolias, and everyone was like, what is this? Not everyone, but some people.
It was after I graduated, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah.
And some people were like, what is this? And I'm like, who are you? Get out.
I wish I had been there for Steel Magnolias, because I would have loved to have been in the stage production of it. But I remember when I got to high school, my friend Elena, we were like comparing movies that we think everyone should see. And I was like, how? Because she hadn't seen The Sound of Music. She hadn't seen Gone with the Wind. I was like, what's wrong with you? And then when she was like, yeah, and I was like, you've seen Steel Magnolias though, right? And she was like, no, I was like, we're going to your house and we're watching it, like, right now. And so I made her a list of like the movies she had to have seen, and at the top, Steel Magnolias and Fried Green Tomatoes.
Well, like, those movies are equivalent to like those books you just have to, like, you have to read The Great Gatsby.
Right.
You have to read Catcher in the Rye.
Well, that was Elena, and my friendship was her telling me what books I had to read and me telling her what movies she had to watch.
So it's just, it does not make sense. Like, how have you never been exposed to it?
Or right.
Had the opportunity to watch it.
And that's what's so funny to me, is I don't even remember being exposed. Like, I just remember it was always there.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like, we had it in the, like, rotation with our Disney movies.
Yeah,
know?
Exactly. And that's, I do have a very vivid memory, though, of when I was about, like, 4 or 5 years old, a preacher using Malin as an example. I don't remember the sermon at all, which is so funny to me, but it was he played the clip of at the hospital,
mm-hmm.
and how she refuses to leave the room, and then like put up the image of her being like the last person by Shelby's grave, about how like your mom is always, it might have been a Mother's Day sermon, I don't know, but it was always like how like the mom is always the person that's right there, like girding you up, will not leave your side. And I think he was using that as an example for like how God walks with us, you know,
mm-hmm.
and is always right there. But anyways, I just remember seeing those scenes like projected on the huge screen at church and being like, wow, Steel Magnolias in church. I have that memory very vividly. And then, but I cannot tell you when the first time I actually saw the movie was,
yeah.
because it was just always there. How many times I've seen it? Probably hundreds. Because this is also a movie that, like, when I find out someone hasn't seen it, I'm like, sit down, we're watching it.
Yeah.
You know? It's a movie that I enjoy being around people for their first viewing, mm-hmm. of. Because it's just such a, it's such a special one, you know?
It is.
And so, yeah.
Also, like, what are your one-liners if you haven't seen this movie?
Exactly. And that's, Erin was telling me earlier, like, she, growing up, she just assumed everyone had seen this movie, as did I. And so there were certain things that both of us would say to other people that we assumed they would understand,
yeah.
were a movie line. Like, I use boil on the butt of humanity, uh-huh. all the time.
I use, Steve's fine over there. And, why am I blanking on this right now?
I
don't, serve him on toast.
Serve him on toast.
I use those three all the time.
I just, it's so, like, these quotes are just part of Southern culture,
mm-hmm.
at this point. So the fact that there are people who, when we would say these things, didn't even know that we were quoting a movie. I'm like, how?
They probably sounded insane to them.
Yeah, it's true. But that's not the only reason we sounded insane to outsiders, Erin. So now I'm going to ask you another beginning question that I always ask on the show, which is, what's your pit and what's your peak of watching this movie? That's your least favorite aspect and your favorite aspect. If you want, we can each give our pits and then each give our peaks.
Okay, least favorite aspect? Okay, hold on.
You want me to go first?
Yeah, you go first.
You've already mentioned mine, but it has to be my pit, is there's something about the staging of the scene when Jackson comes in and the camera is, like, lingering above, like, the simmering spaghetti pot, and
mm-hmm.
you just hear Jack Jr., like, screaming. Like, that's so unnerving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably because, as a young child, I had such an emotional reaction to that scene that, like, I just feel something in my gut every time that scene is on.
And that scene, I said this while we were watching it earlier. Jack Jr. is pointing, my guy. Like, you.
Yeah, he's like, where's your mom?
Over there. Like, go look over there.
Uh-huh.
I'd have to say that my least, like, I don't know if it's my least favorite aspect, but it makes me feel like the most blah is whenever Shelby is telling Malin that she's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Malin's not happy about it because she's like, oh, that's not good for you. You're going to put a lot of strain on your body or whatever. But then Shelby makes the line, and I think it often gets overlooked when she says, I think it'll help things a lot. And you just, if you pay attention to that, you get the idea that things aren't going well in her marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're not exposed to Jackson a whole lot. We have no clue, like, what that's about. But, you know, this being based on a true story, I mean, marriages have problems. And you see Malin just be like, oh, I see. Mm-hmm. And, like, let me be the one to say a baby is never the answer to solving marital problems. But it breaks my heart to see that that's, like, I mean, it's not the only reason she's wanting to have a child, but she's like, you know, if this happens, things will get better.
Mm-hmm.
She's holding out so much hope that things will get better based on this child. And it's like that. You're just going to be disappointed there. Mm-hmm. I hate to tell you.
That is a really heartbreaking line. And you pointed that out when we were watching it this mm-hmm. time. You were like, it's that line, I think this will make things better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because obviously, like, I'm going back to Gone with the Wind, children are life renewing itself, Captain Butler. When life does that, danger seems so unimportant. But at the same time, like, so yes, Jack Jr. makes things better in that, like, he is this new precious life.
Yeah.
But that's the beginning of Shelby's end.
And also, it doesn't, that's like a band-aid for whatever the problem
right.
is. You're just ignoring the problem. And so it hurts my feelings that she is at the point where she thinks, this is what will solve my marital problems.
Right. No, that is a definite pit. Peak? So my peak is possibly a little strange because we're obviously at some point going to talk in depth about the cemetery scene mm-hmm. because you have to. But my peak is the moment, it's like the succession of moments where you see all of the women stepping away from the men in their lives to approach Malin standing alone at Shelby's grave. Like, that just always, it just does something to my heart to
yeah.
see them all be like, hang on, I have to go do this in this moment. Like, in this moment, I'm choosing to prioritize
my friend. Yeah, yours is so much better than mine. Now I'm insecure.
What's yours, Erin?
I really like the wedding scene.
Yeah.
I think it shows, like, they're talking and interacting with all of these people, but they keep coming back to each other
mm-hmm.
to, like, gossip about Janice Van Meter and, uh-huh. To dance and Kyla's performing the dance at the wedding at my wedding, just so you all know. But I just love that. She's just so happy to me. And you see Shelby, like, being a helping hand to Nell with that by inviting her to the wedding, giving mm-hmm. her a dress to wear. I think that's so great. It's just so happy. It just makes me feel.
And it's a so really good great. Establishing moment.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't know, like, how much of the runtime is devoted to the lead up to the wedding and then the wedding itself, but, like, by the wedding scene, you feel like you know all these characters pretty intimately,
yeah.
mm-hmm. which is, like, a no small feat for a movie in its opening sequence. Like, I know, and it's not just the women, like, I feel like I know Drum, mm-hmm. I feel like I know the brothers, like,
yeah.
I have a sense for who all of these people are.
Like, you know Rhett the dog.
Exactly, I really know that dog. That's, I feel so bad for the dog that played that dog. Like, did they shave, like, chunks of
Let's
its fur
the
off? Yeah, exactly. That poor dog. But it's an iconic dog now. So, yeah, that's a good peak. I don't know why you're insecure about that one. That's a good peak.
I don't know. It's just less, like, symbolic. It's more just, like, happy to me.
That's a, but that's, some people just want to be happy when watching movies, so
that's
fine.
True. Not me. I love to cry.
Yeah, for real, we know. So, my next question, Erin, is do you have a favorite shot from this movie?
Ooh. Oh, goodness. I do, actually. I thought about it this time that I watched the movie.
Okay.
It's in the cemetery scene when they I'll get to Malin.
Mm-hmm. And it's Malin's a good one.
Staring at the coffin. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then it's Clary. So Malin is like at the edge of the shot, kind of. Mm-hmm. Then it's Clary, Weezer. There's a space. And then it's Truvy and a nail. So it's like there's a space
for Shelby.
And that just. Mm-hmm. Wow.
That one, I'm really glad you chose that one because I wanted to mention that one, but I had two others that I wanted to mention. So I'm glad you took that one because that one is, it's, oof.
Yeah.
When I think of this movie, I think of that scene and that shot in particular. But this rewatch, two other shots really jumped out at me. One being, I love this moment where it's the kids in the, are in, these kids are in the foreground of the shot lighting sparklers. And Truvy is on her porch in the background of the shot. It's just a really beautiful shot because you're seeing it like through the sparkler.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that one. And then the establishing shot of like the water and the trees and the reflection when Malin is driving.
I had a feeling that would be yours.
Yeah. I said when we were watching it, I was like, I love that shot. Yeah. And because it comes, one thing I really like about that shot that I really thought about on this rewatch is it's such a sad moment. Like, I mean, it seems like this is Malin's, like, at her at the darkest, you know, at the lowest point that we're going to see her in the movie. But you can tell it's a sunrise, not a sunset. And I really like that.
You can also, that car ride is so important to me because, and we'll probably, like, touch on this later on, but we discussed this today, you know. Malin is like being so strong for everyone else. She's alone in that car. She can break down at that moment. But as soon as she gets to Jack Jr., smiles.
Yep.
Hey, Jack.
Yep.
Let me hug you. Everything's fine. So, yeah, that's a really powerful.
It's a great representation of her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The paradox she represents as a character in that point in time. Yeah, absolutely. So, the next question I usually ask on this podcast, Erin, is favorite line. But because this is the movie that it is, I feel like we each need to give multiple favorite lines. So let's just, you just start shouting them out and I'll shout out any I have.
Okay. Well, we've already said a couple. Steve's fine. I say that all the time. At any situation. Also, when the doctor, after the kidney transplant, is, like, pausing and then is, like, looks good. Looks real, real good. I love that line so much.
You love such weirdly specific ones. I
know. Like, this is slightly off topic. One of my favorite movie lines is from The Blind Side, and it's when she's looking at that, I don't know if it's a tapestry or a carpet because it's, like, hung up. And she's saying that it's, like, a remake. And the guy that's trying to sell it to her is like, you're crazy, Leanne. I love that line.
You do like weirdly specific lines, Erin. But you also like the iconic ones from this movie, too.
Yeah.
We'll sell t-shirts.
We'll sell t-shirts saying, I slapped Weezer Boudreaux.
Iconic.
I love that one. I love whenever Weezer is like, I'm an old woman. I'm supposed to wear funny looking hats and ugly clothes and grow tomatoes. I don't make the rules. I just do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
I've just been in a very bad mood for 40 years. That one, so I found out recently that wasn't in the original play script. But the, you know, because the context of that is that Malin is like, why don't you come down to the center?
Mm-hmm.
And the actress playing Weezer in one of the stage plays was like, I just don't feel like Weezer would not have a comeback for that. Like, I feel like for her to be truly in character, she should have a comeback. And so the playwright was like, oh, just say this. And she tried it out, and it got the biggest laugh from the audience that night.
I love that.
And so it stuck, and that's a good one.
It's a good line. Uh-huh. Yeah. I also like when Truvy's like, Shelby, have you been shoving nails up your arm? And Shelby's like, I guess we gotta tell him. And Lynn's like, Shelby has been shoving nails up her arms.
That's a good, that one's good because it's funny, but it's also like kind of poignant because you're like, they don't want to, like, these are their closest friends and they don't even want to tell them, which lets you know that they're both kind of scared.
Yeah.
You know, going into the procedure. Clary telling Jack Jr. the fairy tale.
And the mean, awful witch.
Wretched witch.
Weezer. I've never seen again. Jack, it's your old pal, Weezer.
That kills me every time, because when I was little, my mom and her, my mom's best friend, I call her Granny Pam, and the reason I call her Granny Pam is because, like, she never wanted to be called Grandma or anything like that, and so to mess with her, my mom trained my sister and I to call her Granny Pam, and my mom taught me when I was very little that the way you spell ugly is P-A-M. Yeah, to mess with my Granny Pam, and so I just feel like my mom and my Granny Pam's friendship is very Clary and Weezer-esque.
Yeah.
And so every time I come to that part with her telling Jack Jr. the story, I'm like, that's something my mom would do about Granny Pam, like 100%.
I've also said over there, I do love that line. Let's connect the bald spots. Quit egging him on.
Cause that one is in there multiple times.
Mm-hmm. And then there was another one I was going to mention. Daddy, it's time. That line stands out to me from one of the earliest times that I watched that movie, and I like kind of thought that Drum was very similar to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought they looked alike.
Uh-huh.
And so I was like, Daddy, it's time. Like, I would scream that all the time.
Uh-huh. One that's not even like that, like, funny in context, but I've just always really liked, is when Shelby's like, pink's my signature color.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when I was little, I would go around saying pink's my color all the time. Yeah. And so
I would like tell my grandma, Granny, you know I love you more than my luggage, and she like repeats that all the time. There's another, walk me home, Clary. You just live over there. Yeah.
What? I'm trying to remember, because I wanted us to, usually when we watch, when we do movies on the show with, like, multiple funny lines, I ask, like, what was the funny line that, like, got you the most this time? What was mine? I meant to jot it down. It's at the beginning. It's something Shelby says, I'm pretty sure, right at the beginning.
You should have drowned them at first.
Yes! Yeah, holy cow! I, like, cried at that today, and, like, that's a funny line, but it just usually isn't, like, the one that sticks out above all the others, but today I was like, That's having a sibling, you know?
Gosh, I don't think any of them at this point, like, stand out to me.
Because we just know them all.
But Grape or Aubergine, that's an honorable mention.
Uh-huh.
So is Drinking, Smoking, Jezebel!
Yes.
Nobody move! Where's my contact?
That's very you, Erin. Yeah. That's specific to your lived experience, yeah. I feel like. Yeah. And then I have at least one serious line that I wanted to mention, which I've always loved, even though the context in which it is used is not our favorite scene. But I really love Shelby's, I'd rather have 30 minutes of wonderful than a lifetime of nothing special.
Yeah, that is a good one. Because it looks like she's about to, like, start crying at that point. Mm-hmm. And then Malin, like, looks up at her and is like,
and again, it, like, brings us back to, like, the whole, Jack Jr. is, like I said, the beginning of her end. Mm-hmm. Like, that pretty much seals her fate. But I think Shelby, if she could, would contend that having Jack Jr. at all was worth that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so the fact, looking at her child as her something truly wonderful rather than just nothing special, you know, that it's profound.
Yeah. You know, some would say that. Some might say that she played herself there.
All right, Erin. All right. So moving on, I wanted to ask you, what is it about this movie that you think makes it strike such a chord with certain demographics?
You know, I think the fact that it's inspired by real life events, with, you know, the original playwright writing about his sister and then his mom and her friends and everything. You know, it comes out of real life, and so we're able to identify ourselves with each of the characters, and that just creates something special. It creates a unique experience for each individual, because you can pick out different things and different characters and different things each time you watch it, that are just like, it hits home, and so, and in a good way. It's not like in a, you're looking at the worst aspects of yourself. You're looking at like the realest aspects of yourself and cherishing that, because you cherish these characters.
Yeah, I think you summed it up really well there. Something that a joke I made to Erin as we were watching this film today, because, you know, she's already talked about the wedding scene and how, like, I think, you know, this wedding scene establishes who all these characters are really well. And it's just a good, like, it's like we're getting all the pieces set on the chessboard with this wedding scene. And something about that reminded me very strongly today of The Godfather. And I remarked to Erin that I feel like this movie, not to say that women can't love The Godfather and that men can't love Steel Magnolias, because they absolutely can. And The Godfather is one of my all-time favorite films. But I feel like this is the Southern woman equivalent of The Godfather, in that, like, it's like peak cinema to that demographic. And there's also like a few striking parallels, like it opening with a wedding scene, there being a scene where like your hackles kind of naturally rise because there's a toddler who is like romping around alone and there is someone lying there unconscious, like that. Like, I just feel like we could really draw some parallels between The Godfather and Steel Magnolias. But I think that one of the reasons that Steel Magnolias, you know, strikes such a chord with its target demographic is that it accurately portrays Southern culture. And so many movies are set in the South, but they don't make you feel truly seen as a Southerner. But this one manages to strike that perfect essential balance of, like, This is real life Southern culture here. And I just wanted to ask, what do you think it is about this movie that when you watch it, it doesn't just feel like a bunch of actresses portraying something, like it feels authentic to Southern culture?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with casting. I mean, Julia Roberts and Dolly Parton are true Southerners.
Smyrna, Georgia and Sevierville, Tennessee, baby.
And then, I mean, we see Sally Field as, like, a Southern icon, I feel like.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's, I'm like, she's from California, but we claim her.
Yeah.
Like, she's from the South.
Smoking the Bandit, Forrest Gump. Like,
didn't she, isn't she an Auburn fan?
Oh, I don't know. If so,
don't, Erin. I feel like, because didn't she dated, I'm blanking on his name, Burt Reynolds.
Did she?
Yeah, and he...
I didn't know that they dated.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, because I'm going to do some research, but continue with your point here, Erin.
And so, because of the casting, you know, these aren't... The majority of the women aren't, like, making these abhorrent fake accents, and there's something about, like, hearing yourself in that. Kyla is showing me a picture of Sally Field in an Auburn t-shirt. and so there's something about, like, hearing yourself, you know, like, we can see our, like, people claiming to be Southerners, but unless they, like, have our inflections, we know that they're not a Southerner.
And then on top of the accents, like, the portrayal of the interpersonal relationships of the small town.
Yeah, because, again, I bring up Janice Van Meter again, and, you know, gossiping about Janice Van Meter being hit in the head with a baseball and it being fabulous, you know, and then whenever they're joking about her looking like there's two pigs fighting under a blanket.
Which is, my mom uses that one all the time.
We say things like that.
Like,
you know.
And back to Trent's point, like, the throwing out of a full name and everyone knowing exactly who you're referring
to.
And
backstory and everything. And I think that that really, like, pulls us in, because we're like, oh yeah, this is a small town community where, like, there's not exactly a hierarchy, but each friend group is a separate friend group, and we don't talk about you if you're doing something stupid.
That rotten to the core friend group, Erin.
Real squad.
Real squad. Real squad if you're out there.
We can't say that we miss you, but we do love you.
Okay, speak for yourself, Erin. But yeah, no, I think that that's part of the realism of the portrayal here, is that it nails these interpersonal relationships, which it's like it's casting a light on a part of our Southern existence that I don't feel like any other movie has actually ever specifically tried to shed light on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what makes it so special. I also wanted to ask you, like, do you think that this movie helped kickstart the subgenre of female-led ensemble chick flicks?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, like, again, I think Dolly Parton being part of the cast really, like...
It just elevated it to a whole new level.
Yeah. And then I think people started looking and being like, oh, we can make money off of this. Women want to see themselves, apparently. Let's go for it.
Well, that's like, I just, like, would A League of Their Own have happened without Steel Magnolias? Would, to take one of my favorites, not to make this about a Natalie Portman movie, but would Where the Heart Is have happened without...
Heavy sigh.
But, like, would Where the Heart Is have happened without Steel Magnolias? Probably not.
Right.
So I just really feel like this... We owe a debt to this movie in more ways than it just being a good movie, you know? Also, the generational impact of this movie, because we both, you know, in talking about our experiences, talked about, like, how it's like a coming-of-age moment for a young girl to watch this throughout her growing up with her mom, you know? But we were both talking, we're like, you know, we think that we have a very different emotional connection to this movie than our mothers necessarily do. Because as I was putting together the outline for this episode, I was like, Erin, I'm the same age as Shelby.
Yeah. And you know what's wild about that? I think our moms both had us, like, later on than a lot of people. But they probably saw themselves as Shelby. Like, when they were first watching it, and then had us, and were like, oh no, I'm actually Malin now, and now we're being like, we're Shelby. And it's just a cycle.
And it's just like, I just can't wait to be Clary. Like, I just want to be Clary.
Same. Everybody wants to be Clary.
But it just, it's so interesting to me that, like, our emotional connective tissue right now is Julia Roberts as Shelby. But, like, I'm sure that'll change. Like, eventually, like, I'll feel like Sally Field is Malin, you know? But that just, it's so, I think that's one of the strengths of the film, is that it has a generational allure, you know? Like, it, there's something, you were talking earlier about, like, how there's a character or aspects of characters for everyone to relate to, but there's also, like, central character for wherever you're at in life at that given moment, you know, so you can age with the movie, which I think is really important for its lasting impact, you know, its staying power. Also, one thing that we have to talk about is, I mentioned it earlier, this play is written by a man. This film is directed by a man. How interesting is it that a story that at its core is so intrinsically feminine was written and executed by, it was written by a man, it was executed by a man. Like, how...
Yeah, I think that the execution of it is more ironic to me than the like, playwright. Because the playwright, he's writing, like, his story, or his sister's story, basically. But the execution, it's like, how's this man about to direct these women how to be women?
Sally Field, this is what it's like to lose your daughter as a mother. Like
how? How?
But I think the writing, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think that to me, it's more striking in the writing aspect because I'm just like, there's so, like I said, it's almost like this particular film and then the play obviously shed light on aspects of Southern female culture upon which light has never been shed before. And so it's just like, wow, how, I guess it's not that shocking since like it is like his sister and his mother, but like he must have so intimately been observing them
mm-hmm.
and their friend group in order to so truthfully render what it's like as a woman, as a part of this type of social circle in the American South.
Well, and not to pull out my like psychologist therapist card, but I mean, it wasn't he the middle child?
Mm-hmm. I believe, yeah.
We tend to do that. Us middle children. Like,
all right, Erin.
No, I mean, if you're a middle child, especially if like your older sibling is a different like gender than you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you've got the baby being doted on because they're the baby, the middle child's just kind of sitting back and watching,
mm-hmm.
you know. So he was probably like sitting back and watching, and because like of the way like Southern men operate, like I don't know their lives, but I'm sure his dad was probably like working all the time, and so he probably had a lot more interaction with his mom and her friends.
Mm-hmm.
And being like the one that's kind of not ignored but like not doted on, mm-hmm. I mean, that gives you time to look around and be like, what's going on here? What mm-hmm. what can I observe, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see it. I'm not disagreeing with you, Erin.
Okay.
But I think that it's just so interesting that this feels like such an inherently feminine story,
mm-hmm.
and it's realized by two men.
Yeah.
And I do think on the direction thing, like how the fact that he was so harsh on them in direction, like how do you tell a woman how to behave?
Exactly. Yeah.
In this way, you know.
Yeah. He ain't it.
Oh, Aaron's like, Herbert Ross, I will fight you.
I don't really know what else to say about that man. I just don't, you know, would it be the same film without his influence?
Who can say? You know,
we'll never know that. But we did get a great film and he was involved in it, so can't say that I wish he wasn't involved, but
that's one thing I wanted to talk about briefly here though is the transition from stage to screen. Now neither of us have ever seen like a professional version of this stage play, but I am aware of the differences between the stage play and the film production, and they're very different in nature because the play takes place entirely within Truvy's shop,
mm-hmm.
and the cast is all women. It's just the core women of the group, and it does, like, time passes and everything. It's, like, through multiple different meetings within, you know, getting their hair done at Truvy's, but there's so many things that I think are, there's so many manners in which I think the film is benefited by the film medium, but then there's also ways where I'm like, I feel like you could almost do it better as a play. And so I think so many of the male characters in the film version are just non-entities,
mm-hmm.
and I'm like, it almost would have been better if we didn't even see them.
Yeah,
like
especially Jackson,
like he's the nicest way I can describe Jackson is inconsequential.
Mm-hmm.
Like that man just, he adds nothing to the narrative. And so, like, does visually having him there actually enhance anything at all?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. But then they're, like Drum.
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad we have him.
Oh, yeah. I love Drum.
Mm-hmm. And then there are certain settings I'm glad that we have. Like, I love, like, the carnival, and, like, I love the wedding itself. Yeah. And, like, there's some walk and talks we get that, like, we wouldn't have if they were just sitting in the beauty parlor, mm-hmm. you know? I like that we get Anel's hiring because the play begins like we don't see her like walking up, like we don't see her like encountering town for the first time and all of that, you know. The play kind of begins in the middle of the action.
Yeah.
And so I think that there are things, obviously, like, I literally have a podcast dedicated to film. I think film is the most interesting medium to me personally. Like, I really enjoy the artistry of film. But there are certain things that I'm like, you know, I think this story in particular might be better served with the bottle approach of it all being in one setting and it all being like just strictly these characters. I'm grateful that we got a few extra characters, but on the whole, I don't know, I feel like there's a part of me that's like, well, just how much more intimately could I know these core women if I spent the entire runtime of the film just sitting with them in this one room?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like it'd be kind of weird to be like, get married to this man, and then you never
And then on film not seeing it. Yeah.
You know? But I totally agree with what you're saying, that like, they're not that important. Like,
right. It's like, would I sacrifice these male characters for more time with the women? 100%. Probably, yeah.
Like, especially Clary and Weezer. Like,
yeah.
Give all of the time.
But just thinking about it, we wouldn't get the shopping scene if it wasn't the movie.
That's
like
true.
Them putting all of the beans and then Weezer taking them out. Yeah. Like, there are so many bits of like physical comedy like that where you're just like, oh, that wouldn't translate with just the stage version. So I don't know. I guess I'm saying
like, we gotta see it.
Yeah. You know? I think I'm saying I'm glad we have both.
Yeah.
Like,
I think they each like hold their own in their respective places.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I film is a very, you know, your show don't tell is like the mantra,
mm-hmm.
And that applies especially with film, because you can show things without having to like have the obvious exposition of someone vocalizing them. A stage play, you have to tell, not show.
Yeah, because
you know,
people are in the nosebleeds, can't see it.
Yeah, so I think that keeping it bottled makes sense for a stage production, but. I'm glad that we get the settings and things that we get in the movie. Now, does Jackson become consequential? No.
Absolutely not.
So,
all we know about him is he likes to hunt. And he's a lawyer.
In this house, we do not stand
Yeah, we don't
Jackson.
Like Jackson.
So, one other thing I wanted us to mention before we go through each of the core female characters here is the title paradox, the Steel Magnolia.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you, Erin?
Well, I think this time, watching it through, I had a little bit of a minor epiphany. I kind of like things to be, like, set out to me, you know, to where it's just there, I can pick it up and run with it. But this time around, I was watching it with the intent of, like, analyzing it, and right after Shelby dies, we see Malin like start dictating and being like, here's what you need to do, here's what you need to do. Get her suit, call Clary, call the funeral home. Don't call anyone but this funeral home because it's the best one. You know, she's like taking charge. And her kid just died.
Mm-hmm.
Like, her only daughter just died.
Mm-hmm.
And she's having to, like, be strong. Because all of those men are over there like, boo-hoo, she's dead. Which, like, yeah, it's sad someone died, but, like,
someone has to take care of things right now.
Somebody has to take care of things, and it ends up being Malin.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said, she gets in the car to go get Jack Jr., and just breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that shows not only how women are kind of socialized to be, but how Southern women are especially.
Mm-hmm.
Because we hold femininity and masculinity like in such separate things that like it kind of becomes the job of a Southern woman to protect a man's masculinity almost. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's how we're socialized to be. And that takes strength, you know, if like there's a situation like this and you need to break down, it's like, okay, but let me give this person that usually is coming across as like the big strong man a chance to have his vulnerability, and I'll be the one to take care of him despite the fact that it's like very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that scene was very powerful to me this time. Usually I just pick up on during the cemetery scene whenever Malin says, you know, like, you think that men are supposed to be made of steel or something. Mm-hmm. That's what I kind of pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
But this time that scene just really stood out to me. And
yeah, I think you're right with both of those. I think both those are the two key moments that exemplify like what this title is trying to get across. And I think it's showing us that the expectation is for men to be steel, but the expectation is that women have to be both.
Yeah.
You have to be as steady and strong as steel, and you have to be as delicate as a magnolia.
Mm-hmm.
And Malin, she exemplifies that perfectly.
Yeah.
But all these women do to varying degrees.
Trudy does a great Annel, she doesn't get enough credit.
She doesn't get enough credit. But that's, it reminds me of, to use another Southern colloquial term popularized by Reese Witherspoon, like, you know, she talks about how Southern women are like whiskey in a teacup.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's another really good paradoxical example, you know.
Well, and again, I think that we're kind of socialized, not only as women, but as Southern women, that like, we've got to be this cute little compliment to a man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not usually how things go.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have to like step up and be strong, but then to the public be this cute little dainty thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes that sucks, like mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's sexist, but
this is really interesting. I never thought about this before, but for those of you who don't know, I got my undergrad in Judaic studies, and one of the symbols that is very popular in Jewish media, specifically Israeli media, it's the notion of the sabra, which is the precise opposite of the Southern woman, I'm now realizing, because a sabra is, that's a term used, it's a plant that grows in Israel, but it's a term used for like native Israelis who are born there, and what within the plant, the outside is like prickly, mm-hmm. like a cactus, and the inside has like this really sweet fruit. And so the notion is like on the outside, you're strong and resolute and like you're prickly. On the inside, you're sweet and delicate. But with Southern women, it's the opposite. Mm-hmm. You have to project the delicate nature. You have to project the sweetness. But inside, your resolve has to be made of steel.
Well, and I think that the underlying reason that we've kind of like developed that way is not great, but I think it's awesome that we're able to like show other people that maybe haven't had similar experiences that okay, you could be both, like
mm-hmm.
you can be Dolly Parton rocking that wig and like
you can be flimsy as paper and solid as a rock, Aaron, to quote a Laura Morano song.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was getting at.
We made it an hour and 15 minutes before I quoted a Laura Morano song.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, I mean, you're right in that. She mm-hmm. did say it very well.
She did say it very well. Thank you. I think that I just find the title of this film, this play, to be one of the most like poetic titles I've ever come across. Yeah. Like I really... It's hard. I think titles are hard.
They are hard.
I think titles, and I was laughing at, I saw like a Tumblr post the other day and it was like, title, like, let's make a list of titles that are like actually really dumb, but are just so ingrained in our cultural consciousness, no one questions them. And the first one was Star Wars. They're like, it's not a really great title. Jurassic Park. Like
Fast and Furious,
Alien. They're like, those aren't great titles, but they're just so ingrained. But like Steel Magnolias. That's awesome. A beautiful title. Yeah. I love it. So now I want us to go through each of our Steel Magnolias and talk about the character and also the performance that the actress playing that character gives. So let's start with Daryl Hannah as Annel.
Okay. Yeah. as I just said, I don't think that she receives enough credit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get introduced to her. She's literally walking. We don't know how far, but it's
far enough that Truvy's like taken aback.
Yeah. So literally walking to find a job. She's mm-hmm. like, I need work. This man has just left me. He's a criminal. I have no clue if I'm married or not. My life is in shambles. But you know what? I'm going to go dye some hair. I'm going to go make Truvy's hair so poofy.
Sorry, it's a little too poofy.
And I'm going to become this. I'm going to heal from this. I'm going to become the strong woman. I may be like bogged down right now, but you know what? Give it a year or a few months or whatever. And guess what? You're going to see me in this rocking outfit with my hair dyed blonde. I'm going to be drinking, smoking, and Jezebeling. And you know
and
what?
Dating Sammy.
And dating Sammy. And you know what? What of it? You know, like I'm putting my life back together. And I love Anil.
I do too. And I think that it's so important that Anil is the person who sets the cemetery scene in motion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Anil is the catalyst for this whole movie.
Yeah,
you
because, know? I mean, we entered the movie with her.
That's exactly what I was going to say. She is our Lynn's character. And I'm very interested in Lynn's characters. Like, I think that it's, you know, we have a predisposition to attach ourselves emotionally to that character. Like, I think, you know, like with Friends, Rachel is our Lynn's character. And so a lot of women, Rachel is their favorite character on Friends. Rachel, the first time I watched Friends, was my favorite character. Now my favorite character is Monica. We won't get into all of that. but I think that, you know, there's something so special about the narrative device of the character with whom the audience begins to encounter all these characters and situations, you know? And Anil doesn't get the credit that most Lynn's characters do. Like, most people recognize, like, oh, I am experiencing this along with this person, and so I'm going to emotionally attach myself to them. In my experience, though, not that many Steel Magnolia fans, like, attach themselves most strongly to Anil.
Right.
But she really is an incredible character. She's one that I wish I spent more time with throughout the duration mm-hmm. of the film.
She's busy praying. She ain't got time.
Yeah, exactly. but I love her character arc. I think she gets some really great laughs.
Yeah.
And
not
I think
on your first visit.
Exactly. And I think that it's so important. She's the catalyst for the entire thing. And so, of course, she's the catalyst of the emotional climax. She's the one that steps right up there next to Malin and is telling her, like, how she finds comfort in this. And even though that doesn't necessarily automatically extend comfort to Malin, it allows her the emotional space within which she can have her breakdown in front of all of her friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, this is another side note. I think that's so interesting that you pointed that out. Sometimes we're taught to be, like, steel towards our friends as well, you mm-hmm. know, and Anil really tells Malin, you know, like, it's okay, you can be the Magnolia in this situation.
Uh-huh.
We'll be your steel and help you through it. So
yeah, and I think that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anything else about Anil before we move on? Daryl Hannah does a really good job. I do want to say that
she does,
because Anil has, there's some versatility required in that mm-hmm. role. She's,
I mean, we mentioned this while we were watching it. She has a different hairstyle, like, in every scene.
Yeah, yeah. And for her to be so awkward and aloof at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And also, she's kind of the first character, even though you don't necessarily maintain the strongest emotional attachment to her, she's the first character that you feel, like, really sympathetic for. Like, she's got that early moment where she confesses to Weezer and everyone, and, like, your heart goes out to her. And Daryl Hannah just manages to play all of the many iterations of Anil very well. Also, I wanted to point out the necklace. We joked that we think she's wearing the necklace that says Anil, because if she wasn't, it would take you a moment each scene to figure out, like, oh, that's still Anil. She has even though she has a different hair color now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think Daryl Hannah does a really good job, and I can't imagine anyone else.
No, I couldn't either, because, like, you said the fun fact about her, like, having to come and dress up or whatever.
Uh-huh.
She's just so, like, lanky. Uh-huh. And, like,
gawky and, like, awkward. Like, her
elbows and knees could, like, kill someone. Like, that's just a nail, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She is lanky and awkward.
And I really enjoy her performance at the cemetery scene. I think that it's, like, pitch perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one thing that all of these actresses do really well that I'm just going to go ahead and point out specifically with Daryl Hannah so that I don't have to point it out with all of them, even though it is true of all of them, they're really good at knowing which moments to portray, like, as restrained.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's not necessarily that they're always trying to be strong, but they know which moments to let the characters have their breaking points. Because it would have been really easy, I feel like, for Daryl Hannah to oversell Annelle's monologue at the cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't. She lets it be, like, this quiet moment, and then Sally Field's moment is the big breakdown moment. Mm-hmm. And it just plays so beautifully. And it could have been read a completely different way. And so I really appreciate the character choices Daryl Hannah made.
Yeah, I agree with you with that.
So next up, we have Trudy.
Love her.
I mean, like, what can we say
about
Dolly Parton? Also, like, that role just had to be Dolly Parton.
Oh, yeah, it does. But, like, the Trudy character, like, Dolly Parton removed from it, which mm-hmm. feels weird to say, but, you know, like, the hairdresser is part of Southern culture. Like,
oh, yeah.
I tell my hairdresser stuff, I don't tell my priest. Like,
honestly,
I go into it.
Angie, if you're listening, which you're probably not, but you, like, Angie, my hairdresser knows more about me than anyone, I think.
I mean, I think about my grandmother being like, she used to go to the beauty parlor each week at the same time on Fridays.
Mama Golden went the same time on Thursdays every week.
I mean, and it was like a gossip fest.
Uh-huh.
They would all sit there and gossip. I mean, such a good choice to make, like, the like center,
the glue of the friend group, and the hairdresser
in the beauty parlor.
Uh-huh.
Like, wow, genius.
Mm-hmm. Truly inspired Southern character choice right there. And then Dolly Parton just kills it.
Mm-hmm.
Dolly Parton, she honestly, like, back to, I feel like, how it could just be read versus, like, breathing life into it, she makes Truvy so much even more likable than she has any business being.
Yeah.
You know.
And let's take a moment and appreciate, like, Trudy has marital problems, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that gets, like, I don't think people spend enough time on that.
Yeah, I agree.
Going through the movie. I mean, she tries so hard to make things work with Spud. And he's just like,
out on the rig, sorry.
Yeah, I need a job. Uh-huh. Which, like, financial stress is a big thing in, like, relationships. And that's a realistic thing to throw in there, but, like, she could have easily been like, I'm sick of this, I'm out of here, but no, she said, I'm gonna stick through this, and I'm gonna make my marriage work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that takes a lot of courage, and a lot of self-confidence, and self-evaluation.
Am very intrigued by Trudy as a character, on the basis that she is the person who wants to know everyone else's, like, interpersonal relationship drama, and she helps other people deal with their problems, but at no point do we see Trudy being transparent about her own problems.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting to me, but that's very true to life of a lot of Southern women.
Yeah.
Like, they will, like, be invested in everyone else's, but they're not going to be revealing their own.
Yeah.
And that's...
I mean, she does make, like, these little comments, like, the most romantic thing my husband... Or the last romantic thing my husband did for me was enclose this garage so that I could provide for him.
You know?
Like, we see that, but we never see, like, how she's processed.
No, like, she never breaks down and vents.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Everyone else vents to her.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably not healthy, but... No,
but I think that can happen.
That happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and like I said, Dolly Parton, she could have come across as kind of, I don't know, one-dimensional, maybe? Mm-hmm. Or even, like, too invested in drama. Like, mm-hmm. she could have just not been presented as, like, the nicest person, but she is because of the life Dolly breathes into her.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I would just like to say that I believe, that Truvy is an Enneagram 6 Wing 7. and I just want to put that out there.
All right. What, do you want to give all of them their Enneagrams as we go? Okay, so what's a nail?
A nail? Oh, a nail's hard. I think a nail is... I think she's a 2 Wing 3.
Okay. All right, so a nail, 2 Wing 3, Truvy, 6 Wing 7. Mm-hmm. All right, next we have the dynamic duo of Clary and Weezer.
Yeah. Do you want me to go ahead and give their Enneagram?
Whatever order in which you want to do it.
I think Clary is a 7 Wing 6.
Okay.
And I think that Weezer is an 8 Wing 9.
Okay, yeah, Weezer's definitely an 8. I know nothing about the Enneagram, and I know that.
Yeah. But what can I say? I love these characters.
Okay, honestly, quite possibly my favorite fictional best friendship.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all see each other, like, as them at some point, you know? Because I know with me and my older sister, we always joke, like, who's Clary, who's Weezer? Because
you're Clary, Catherine's Weezer.
And with Natalie, though, Natalie... is Clary, I'm Weezer.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, things are different. So, I just love them. I think they give the most appropriate amount of comedic relief possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
And also, flawless. they both represent character types that you actually come across in the American South. Mm-hmm. Like, you got the curmudgeon... Like, of a neighbor, but who
Some
actually...
Some of you are in my family. Anyway.
But who actually has a heart of gold, but, like, doesn't want anyone to realize it. And then, like, come on, the affluent, widowed, like, former mayor's wife. Yeah. Like, that's just... That's such a good Southern trope right there.
That'll be Lolo.
That will be Lolo. Lolo is gonna be Clary. Holy cow. Lolo already is Clary.
Yeah, she is. Mikey's just still
He's
alive.
Still here, yeah. Oh, that's so funny. But yeah, no, they, like, I genuinely do think they're one of the most iconic film best friendships.
Mm-hmm. Get off my bitch. Have your roots done.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good. It's so good. And it, I love that at no point does the movie feel the need to, like, strip them bare and, like, have, like, this big heart-to-heart moment revealing, like, the strength of their friendship. Like, we just know.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't.
Especially when she's screaming at Clary to get off her bench.
Right. Like, and it just, like, I don't know, I feel like there's this, like, burden on, like, friendships in media a lot of times that we, like, in modern culture, we joke about, like, the roast to love ratio. Mm-hmm. And, like, I feel like in film media, there's this burden that, like, you have to show, you have to stop the roasting and show the love. But, like, we don't have to in this scenario. Like, we know how Clary and Weezer actually feel about each other. Mm-hmm. And they know, too. And they don't have to communicate it with words.
Yeah.
Or even actions. It's just known. Mm-hmm. Which I really appreciate.
Walk me home, Clary. You just live over there.
And that's... But listen, she roasts her so hard for that, but she walks her home.
Yep.
And that's the core of it all.
Yep.
Right there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Malin.
Oh, Malin. I mean, she really is just, like, the best analogy for the title. I mean, she is. We've touched on this already. But, you know, but I also think that she shows Southern moms, like, how much they love to be involved in their daughter's lives. Mm-hmm. And the struggle, like, once, you know, whenever, after the wedding scene, when Shelby's getting ready to leave and, like, needs help with the corsage and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And Shelby's like, you're finally rid of me. And Mullen's like, I think you'll be back every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that just shows, like, it's so difficult for moms and daughters to, like, go.
To let each other go.
I mean, and it reminds me of, like, Demeter and Persephone, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they... Malin and Shelby are that classic mother-daughter relationship, but with a Southern element put into it. Because Southern moms, I feel like it's amplified.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just love your daughters, you know? And you're teaching them to be the Southern woman that you are, basically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we just... I have no words for Lynn other than that. Like, I just, it's just a perfect portrayal, in my opinion.
I completely agree. I think that she is the exemplar of the paradoxical, poetic Steel Magnolia. And I think that nothing reveals that paradoxical, poetic nature of Southern women more than tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so to see her walk through that tragedy, like, that just, it's a crucible that strips her down to the most, like, core attributes of a Southern woman.
Mm-hmm.
And Sally Field portrays it so perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know we can't imagine anyone else in any of these roles, but, like, especially, come on. Sally Field as Malin. Like, mm-hmm. it's, I cannot extricate the character from Sally Field mm-hmm. in my brain.
No, I see any other movie that I see Sally Field in, I see Malin. Like, I almost don't see
Sally Field.
Yeah, like, or the character that she's supposed to be playing.
Uh-huh.
It's Malin trying to play a character.
That's so funny. But I understand that. And I think that, like, she just does it so beautifully. The scene in the car,
mm-hmm.
But the cemetery scene is the one
goodness.
Like,
this gets me.
And knowing that was one take,
mm-hmm.
like, holy cow. But the moment that always gets me most about that is it's Sally Field's, her portrayal, the way she says the lines of, like, I'm not going to get it verbatim because it makes me so emotional that, like, I don't even know that I could do it all verbatim, but the, when she's talking about, like, how she, I'm fine, and she's like, I can walk.
Yeah, I've always
Always been able to, and my daughter couldn't.
Yeah, I've, like, always been prepared to go first. This is
right, but
I,
like,
I just want to hit something, I want to hit right. hard.
But, like, the notion that, like, she's mad at her own body for being capable,
mm-hmm.
like, that's just so,
and not being able to make her daughter capable
exactly
is what I gather from it. She's, like, mad at herself for not being able to fix
right, like, she body. would give her capability to Shelby in a heartbeat, mm-hmm. if she could, and that just, it's so heartbreaking. And Sally Field, to know that, like, Sally Field is a mother, but has never, for Sally Field to be able to portray so realistically an experience she herself has never walked through is so incredible,
mm-hmm.
to me. I'm blown away by her. And she just comes across as so, like, affable and, like, likable and nice.
Well, and let's also think about, like, some of the scenes that people like to judge her on whenever Malin is, like, mad that Shelby's pregnant, and everyone, I feel like a lot of people are like, you should be happy regardless. That's her kid, mm-hmm. you know? Like, she is mad that, like, her kid is hurting herself when mm-hmm. it's someone that she loves so ardently.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, why are you doing that? I'm so mad at you.
My runner-up for my pit, which I didn't think to mention earlier, but it goes really well right here, is Malin's delivery of, does he listen? She's like, I know you don't, but does he listen?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how terrifying would that be as a mother to know that your daughter's about to go through something that you want to be able to protect her from, but she took that right away from you by not heeding your advice?
Yeah.
You know? And the notion that, again, not to make this the let's crap on Jackson hour, but, like, but she's like, well, he's supposed to be the one to protect you now, and he's not protecting you. And he's not protecting you. He's not listening. And she's like, someone has to take responsibility for you. Like, someone has to be the one who's going to be thinking about your safety, and it's not going to be you, and it's not going to be your husband. So, like, you're putting this burden on me still,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's heartbreaking, too.
It is.
Like, Malin really gets dealt some awful hands mm-hmm. throughout the course of this movie.
She does. And I think she handles it with the grace that any Southern woman could.
The grace that I could only hope to have as a Southern woman. Do you want to give us Malin's Enneagram type?
Okay. She is a one wing two, because the one is the perfectionist,
mm-hmm.
and like likes to follow rules and everything. And so Malin always being like, the doctor said that like you can't do this, you can't do that. But she's also constantly trying to help other people, not just in her relationship with Shelby, but because of like her position at the guidance center.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
they were good. One, two.
One other moment that I want to mention, Sally Field's acting. I can't believe I haven't mentioned this yet. When she's reading the magazine to Shelby and Drum's trying to get her to leave. And she's like, what if she wakes up for 2 minutes and I'm not here?
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Like pushes Drum away.
Yeah. But that is, like I said, just the way Sally Field is able to bring to life experiences she herself has not had is so incredible.
Yeah.
All right, so, I mean, we gotta talk about Julia Roberts as Shelby.
Okay. Shelby, Enneagram, hold on. Shelby's a 4, I think, but I don't know what her wing would be. Maybe okay. a 3.
Okay.
Maybe. But the 4 is, like, I mean, it comes across negatively, but it's not always negative. 4s are self-centered. You know, and I mm-hmm. think Shelby is very much like she pays attention to her own needs and her own wants and mm-hmm. then like other people's second. You know, like, mm-hmm. no, mom, I want a kid. I'm going to have a kid. I'm sorry it makes you upset. But like, we give him birth up in here, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, so yeah, I think she's a 4 and maybe balanced wings. I don't know.
Okay. I think that it's interesting. Like, we were talking about, like, our emotional connection at this point in our lives is Shelby.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so weird for me having the realization earlier that at the beginning of the film, Shelby's supposed to be 22, and I'm 22.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've watched this movie my whole life, and now I'm, at this
well,
point, I'm the exact
same. She always seems so much older,
so yeah, yeah, exactly. But I just, I don't even know how to put into words. Like, I think Shelby, Anel is our Lynn's character. But Shelby is the emotional core,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. Because, and that's not to say that she has the emotional climax resting on her shoulders, because she doesn't. Malin does. But it's because we care about Shelby that Malin's emotional climactic scene has the impact that it does.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't know that anyone else could have brought the gravitas to the role that Julia Roberts does.
I agree with you on that. And one thing that I want to mention as well, you know, I think that Shelby's character just shows us, like, such a carefree young woman. You
mm-hmm.
know, when her mom's running around at the beginning of the movie and, like, there's broken champagne glasses and Shelby's like,
my nails.
Yeah, practically pink my foot. This uh-huh. color's too dark.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Flush and bashful.
You know, like, she's so worried about, like, things that don't matter all that much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how a lot of us are at that age.
Right, it's a realistic
at
portrayal,
this age, I guess.
I think. Yeah, it's a realistic portrayal, and I think that's part of the tragedy of Shelby, mm-hmm. though, is that she seems, you know, we said, you know, she seems so old to us as kids, but she always seems so young comparatively to all the other characters.
Yeah, to everyone else.
And that she is so, like, she's not even thinking about the future because she assumes she has a future.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, Shelby thinks that she's invincible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really think that she does. Like, she has no sense of her own mortality
yeah.
at all. And that makes her death that much more tragic.
Yeah.
Because I don't think she herself had any idea that she was at the point she was at physically.
I don't think so either. I think she figured, oh, there'll always be something that can, like, make me better,
mm-hmm.
you know. I'll always be able to get a kidney transplant.
And that's what she's like, you know, in Shreveport, they do 3 or 4 a day,
yeah.
like, or a week, what is it, I don't know.
It's not weird.
Yeah, she's like, it's fine, like, and so, it just, Malin is the only one considering how serious and dire Shelby's circumstances are. That doesn't make Shelby a bad person
no,
at all. It makes her a realistic early 20-year-old.
Yeah. yeah.
Like, so, but
just living life and living life the way she wants it to be lived, you
right.
know, without any fear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just I'm gonna do what I want, and it'll be fine.
But Julia Roberts endows her with so many attributes that just seem intrinsic to Julia Roberts' portrayal specifically. Mm-hmm. And like, it's not that Shelby wouldn't be likable without Julia Roberts at all, because like, she would be, like you brought up, you know, like her inviting Annelle and like letting Annelle have the dress and like stuff like that. Like, yes, like she does have, like, she's a likable character, like at face value. But Julia Roberts, like, I said when we were watching it today, I was like, you know, there are performances that actors and actresses give where you can point at that performance and be like, you know, it's not that they deserve the Oscar for this performance, but I can tell you based off of this performance, this person is going to deserve an Oscar at some point.
Yep.
And to me, this is Julia Roberts's performance like that. Like, I point at this and I'm like, duh, that woman has an Oscar now. The first scene where she has the spell where her insulin has spiked.
Yes.
Like, that, it's so realistic. It's so perfectly played. And, like, that's not an easy thing to portray.
Right. I wonder how much research went into that.
Yeah.
You know?
For real.
I wonder if she, like, interviewed people or...
I feel like she probably did. I feel like she's that kind of actress, yeah. You know? But... And also, like, that scene is a really, we haven't mentioned that scene yet, but that's a really impactful scene to us as the viewer with Annelle as our lens character, because Annelle is, like, taken aback. She's like, should I call the ambulance? Yeah. Like, what's, and it lets you know so easily without having to say it out loud, like, how intrinsically linked all these women are, because everyone jumps into action. Everyone knows exactly what to do. And Trudy's like, no, we don't need to call the police. We don't need to call the ambulance. Like, we're
fine. We got it.
Like, because that lets us know how much time these women spend together, that they are all intimately aware of how to handle this situation.
Also gives us a glimpse into small town Southern culture as well.
Yep.
You know, we all know each other so well that we know, like, who is sick, who's got something going on, and, like, what needs to be done about it. Because
right.
We all jive in, like, the same circles.
Mm-hmm. Something else I wanted to point out about that scene, I love that, like, they're talking about, like, her bridal party, and she's like, yeah, I've got 9 or whatever, but like, they're,
I had my cousins and my, yes,
but they're talking, you would think that the bridal party would be like the people that know her best in the world, and but like, she's spending the morning of her wedding at the beauty parlor with all of these older women. Like, that just tells you how close she is with these women. Like, she's not with her bridal party, and in fact, she's kind of talking crap about her bridal party.
Let's also note, I feel like that's how that goes with a lot of small town weddings. Like,
yeah.
You put people in your wedding because you have to, not because you want to.
Uh-huh.
So, that's a good, like, little additive.
It is. So, now that we've discussed all of the specific characters and the portrayals of the actresses that play them, we just got to take a moment for the accents.
Yeah.
You mentioned them earlier, but I wanted to mention my friend Elena, who I mentioned at the top of the show, when she was one of the people I could not believe had never seen this movie because she grew up in South Georgia. She complains about Julia Roberts' accent in this movie. And I just want to take this moment to soapbox against Elena Rent,
yes,
and say that Julia Roberts' accent in this movie is amazing and great because it's the only one that's real.
Exactly.
I mean, Dolly's is real, but Dolly's Dolly. Like, she's the only actress accent,
right,
that is real. Julia Roberts grew up in Smyrna, Georgia. Fun fact, one of my favorite fun facts of all time. When Julia Roberts was born, Coretta Scott King paid the hospital bill. Because Julia Roberts' parents ran an acting camp that Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King's children attended.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids really loved Julia Roberts' parents. And so the King family wanted to do something nice for them. And they knew that Julia Roberts' mother was very pregnant. And so they called ahead and paid the hospital bill for the birth of the child.
Oh,
and it was,
wow,
Julia Roberts. Is that not the coolest,
that,
like,
is so cool,
most Georgia fun
that
fact
is, yeah,
ever? Julia Roberts, like, she grew up in Georgia. Homegirl's accent is real, and you can tell.
Yeah.
Like,
when she says, like, him.
Uh-huh.
And everyone else is like, him.
Uh-huh. Like, that's what she stresses the right syllables. She adds syllables in the right places. She enunciates just the right way. And so, sorry, Elena, but you're wrong.
You're wrong.
Julia Roberts' accent,
okay, but
is good.
The worst accent.
the worst accent.
I have my opinion on it. I hate that this is my opinion.
Okay.
Think Olympia Cleary.
Really? Yeah. I was going to say that I'm actually, like, I was going to use hers as one of the ones that I think is good.
No, I...
When you take into account that she's Greek.
Okay, yeah.
Like...
But it's just, like, whenever, at the beginning of the movie, before the wedding, she's, like, comes to Truvy's to get her hair done. She's windblown, and she, like, goes into the bathroom to change out of her dress from mm-hmm. the dedication she was just at. She busts up out of the bathroom and is like... I don't know how Malin puts up with that. That's awful. We do not say puts like that.
Uh-huh. Okay, all right. I will say, though, to her credit, and this is not just because I'm a Cleary stan, because I love Cleary.
Oh,
Cleary might be my favorite. But I think that it's a little bit of a different beast with Olympia Dukakis, not because she's Greek, but because Cleary... doesn't just have a Southern accent. Cleary is speaking dignified Southern.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
True.
And so, like, it's not that Cleary wouldn't talk just like me and you. Cleary would talk.
Like, she'd talk more like Savannah-esque.
That's what I was going to say. She'd be like a Sandra Deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But still, there's just something about it where I'm like, this is clearly fake.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give you that one a little bit. We didn't really talk that much about Olympia Dukakis and Shirley MacLaine in terms of portrayal because we fixated so strongly on the friendship between
yeah.
Cleary and Weezer. But I did want to say, I think Olympia Dukakis plays Cleary with exactly
yeah.
the right brand of, like,
who
dignified.
Else could be Cleary,
yeah.
You know?
It's so perfect. And then, come on, Shirley MacLaine
yeah.
is,
yeah,
it just can't be topped.
Yeah.
But I think, though, so, like, Dolly's accent is also real. So, like, that one, we don't even have to, like, it's Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
She...
Okay, wait, I think I changed my answer, actually.
Well, hang on, let me say one other great accent is Sally Fields.
Yeah.
Sally Fields, and I think it's because she's so ingrained in Southern culture, she's
mm-hmm.
played Southern characters before, but, like, I always feel like her Southern accent sounds so authentic.
Yeah.
I will say, except her Where the Heart Is accent leaves a little bit to be desired.
I didn't know that she was from California until, like, 5 years ago.
I always thought Sally Field was from the South.
Yeah, so good job, Sally Field.
Yeah, you duped us. I'm interested to see who you've amended your answer to, because I'm wondering if it's going to be my vote for worst.
I now think that Olympia is second worst.
Okay.
A nails.
Yeah, that's my worst, too. And it's... Daryl Hannah, I love you.
Yeah.
And I think that Annelle is great, but it might be something in her character choice for Annelle, like, in that, like, Annelle is kind of soft-spoken.
To me, it sounds very voice-coachy.
It sounds like a non-Southerner's approximation of what a Southerner would sound
yeah.
like, you know? So, but... No hate on Annelle. I love her.
No, none at all. You know, it's difficult. Not everyone's blessed to have our accent.
Exactly. But that was when you asked who least favorite. That's mine. Not least authentic sounding,
yeah.
I would say. But also, I'm biased because I'm not gonna say Olympia Dukakis has the worst just because she's Cleary. So, I wanted to ask you, Erin, though. And I know the answer to this question, but, like, is this the definitive Southern woman film?
Oh, for sure. Hands down. I don't even know what else it could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe Fried Green Tomatoes, but no.
This one, there's a hierarchy, and this
yeah.
is number one, and Fried Green Tomatoes is number two.
Yeah.
And then I don't even know. It drops off after there.
I don't know what else could be on.
And I wanted to ask you this, though, because this is something that is so interesting to me. Why do you think that this film is so many people's comfort food movie? That's something I've talked about extensively on this podcast before, is the notion of a comfort food movie, like the movie you return to so often, and it feels like eating your favorite meal or something. And, you know, you talked about how you, like, when you go home, you watch this movie, you can just put this movie on, and, like, you don't even have to dwell on it. It's just there as, like, to comfort you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so interesting to me because this isn't a very, like, happy-go-lucky movie. Like, it deals
yeah.
with some very tragic things, has some very sad elements, and yet you're right, when I watch it, I feel comforted at the end. So what is it about it that helps it walk that line of that delicate balance?
I have two things that I want to say. The first one I've already kind of touched on. I think it's because we can all see ourselves in each of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to, like, go into that again since we've already talked about it. But I think that that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the second point is I think the movie does a great job of, you know, when Jack Jr.'s in the swing and Melina's like, life goes on, and then you see the movie ends with, like, a now giving birth, Easter, it's supposed to be, like, springtime, the time of mm-hmm. rebirth. I think that the movie leaves you on such a positive note that it, in a way, it almost helps me, like, this is kind of heavy, but it, I feel like that movie and the early exposure I had to that taught me coping mechanisms for how to deal with, like, the crappy things that life gives out to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because life goes on. This too shall pass, you know, and I think mm-hmm. I think it does a great job of showing that. Like, yes, this sucky thing happened, and it was awful, and we had deep, dark emotions about it,
mm-hmm.
but it does not negate the fact that happiness is still out there
mm-hmm.
with, like, the flip of a scene, you know?
I agree. I completely agree. And I think that one of the key things that's so comforting about the end of the movie, too, is, yes, absolutely, life goes on. Yes, you know, and now having a baby and planning to name it Shelby. It's the notion that life goes on, but what was endured is not forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Because she wants to name the baby Shelby. You see all these women that were so integral in Jack Jr.'s mother's life interacting with him. And so, you know, because one of the saddest parts to me is Malin lamenting, like, will he even know mm-hmm. what a special person his mother was? And when you see those women all around him at the Easter picnic, you're like, yeah, he's going to know.
Yeah, that question is answered.
Yeah, he's going to know. Yeah. And that's, yeah, I think that's the comforting part of the end to me, to be like, that baby's going to grow up with the greatest little support system of his mother's friends from that beauty parlor.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that in itself is comforting.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that Shelby set up Sammy in Annelle. Like,
right.
That is her lasting, other than Jack Jr., that's her lasting legacy, is she created that family, basically.
Right, and her impact did not die with her.
Yeah.
You know? So, Erin, I always wrap up with this two-part question for all my guests. I always ask them, which I know your answer to this first question, but I always ask, one, is this a film worth rewatching?
Well, yeah.
Okay, and two, how would you convince someone of that fact? Say you're talking with someone and they're like, yeah, I've seen Steel Magnolias, but, and they don't plan to ever rewatch it again. What's your elevator pitch to convince them that it is worth revisiting?
Well, I think anything worth doing once is worth doing twice, honestly.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And so I think that there's so much in this movie that you can rewatch it so many times and still pick up. I mean, like I said earlier in the podcast, like, I've seen this movie hundreds of times, and I had never picked up on Malin, like, having to be strong for the men in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Never picked up on that. Maybe that's because I'm dumb. Who's to say?
You're not dumb. That's why we rewatch things.
But, like, you know, you pick up on little subtleties that make the movie that much better.
Mm-hmm.
And so any movie that you took the time to watch, you should probably watch it again. You know, with exceptions. Natalie Portman movies.
Erin, we'd almost made it all the way through.
You should have known better.
Are you going to go on a spiel about Natalie Portman, or you want me to cut it off here?
Why don't you give your introduction to how you see my thing of Natalie Portman, and then okay. I will tell you why you're wrong.
Why I'm wrong? What do you mean? Natalie Portman gives Erin the uh-oh feeling. That's how Erin describes
but, like,
it.
Okay, I just think if you sit down and you watch her filmography, okay, especially her, like, late 90s, early 2000s movies, there is something there.
Yeah, this
that just no. Something there that just makes you feel like Ted Bundy's near you, or that, like, she is brainwashing you, or that you're doing something you shouldn't be doing.
Aaron is just defensive because Aaron needs to be contrarian to me. And
that's
so,
not true. I think we've spent a whole podcast agreeing on things.
Which is really good for us, I have to say.
But Natalie Portman is terrifying.
Because Natalie Portman had to concoct a media image of herself that she thought would protect her from predatory men. From predatory men. Yeah. She had to scare people off.
She's not scary in a traditional sense. She's scary in the fear of the unknown. That this woman, and I, you know, I hate to be so cruel to her. I do.
What if she's listening right now, Erin?
I've heard that she, you know, has done some awesome things. But there... There's just something, every time I watch one of her movies, I'm like, something's wrong. Something bad is about to happen. Every time. Yeah. Except for Jackie.
Something
bad already happened in that movie.
All right. I'm going to show Erin Black Swan and have her back on for that episode soon.
I've never seen it because I'm already scared of her, so why would I scare myself further?
All right, we need to wrap this up. Is there anything else that you think bears mentioning before we officially close out this show, Erin?
No.
All right, you think we've said it all?
I think so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being my guest, Erin.
Yes, please have me back. I'd love to.
I will. It's been a long time coming. I've been trying to get Erin on the show since the show started up, basically. And I'm
simply busy.
I'm glad that this was our first movie, though.
I am too. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that it would be.
Yeah. So this has been Play It Again, Kyla. As always, if you have suggestions of films you would like to hear discussed, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find the podcast with the handle Play It Again, Kyla on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. And you can find me personally. That's not true. The podcast is not on Letterboxd. I've done this outro a million times and never messed it up. And of course, the first time Aaron's here would be the time that I would mess it up. You can find me personally at @Kyla_Z_Percival on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. And you can find the podcast with the handle Play It Again, Kyla on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Once again, I am your host, Kyla Percival, signing off and saying I voted for Andy Kaufman.